Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Cultural diversity is increasing in the United States, and it really is doing the same in healthcare. Today, we're going to be discussing how to appreciate cultural differences and how to use that information to provide better healthcare. Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Danielson of the University of Washington Department of Pediatrics. And Dr. Danielson is also a medical director of the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle. You can reach us during the next hour or so at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Danielson, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Hi, Dr. Woodward, and thank you for the invitation.
Let's ease into this topic a little bit, and I think the way I would like to do it is just start with a little bit about yourself, what brought you into medicine and to pediatrics and the University of Washington and then to Odessa Brown Clinic.
I came out to the University of Washington for medical school partly because they had such a great reputation in evidence-based practices, and research had a lot of the NIH grant money going there, and had this really strong tradition in preparing a whole Northwest region of physicians. And so I appreciated that sort of combination of understanding regional needs and having a scientific bent. And I was lucky enough to do my residency at Seattle Children's Hospital and stuck around, and afterward got my dream job, a job at the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic, which is in the heart of Seattle, and just I work with amazing people for amazing people.
You said, I guess maybe other listeners are like me, you were impressed with the evidence-based practice, the science, the really good reputation of the University of Washington, all of its programs. And your dream job was in a, hopefully I'm not letting the cat out of the bag too much, an inner city clinic in Seattle. And I'm wondering if people think that is incongruous in some way.
I guess it depends on how you think about, you know, what's meaningful and rewarding to you. And for a lot of people like me who sort of wended their way through their training and explore different opportunities in different ways of practicing healthcare, there's something fundamentally meaningful and rewarding and just connected about working within communities. And then on top of that, the chance to be of some help, some benefit, hopefully, within communities that have high levels of healthcare difficulties, higher rates and severity of disease, and more of the rest of the challenges that are actually the more important parts of what influence our health. That's just an incredible opportunity. And so I do think of it as a dream job and the privilege of being able to work with communities that have great strengths and great character and great diversity is just a wonderful thing.
Tell us a little bit more then about the clinic. What's the ethnic makeup, the socioeconomic background of the individuals you're seeing there? Where you're located?
Sure. The clinic is in the heart of downtown Seattle, so sort of uphill from where Pioneer Square and things like that would be. Ironically, it's on Yesler in Seattle, which has the notability of being the original Skid Row. That's where loggers used to slide logs down from Lake Washington into the harbor there. So Yesler, the road that our clinic is on, is the original first named Skid Row. The clinic is in the central area, which in the 50s and 60s was really the center of the African-American community in Seattle and was going to be sort of a strong cultural center full of vibrancy, you know, with jazz and churches and lots of the cultural icons that made the African-American community really strong in that time in Seattle. Over the next decades, the area has become more diverse and more gentrified. And so a lot of the traditional families that used to come to our clinic, their next generations have moved further south, but they still travel by a couple of buses or by however they can into the central area to get their church, to get their haircuts, and to get their pediatric care. So our clinic serves around 55% African-American families. We serve about 17 to 18% Spanish-speaking. We serve a broad host of recent and not-so-recent immigrant families that come from the Horn of Africa and East Africa areas, from Southeast Asia, from former parts of USSR, just all over the world. It's an amazingly diverse waiting room. I just love sitting in there sometimes and listening to the many different voices and the clothing and the colors, and it's a wonderful spot.
You said something earlier that I want to follow up on, and we actually talked about it a little bit more, and listeners might have noticed that you said these types of the patients you're seeing have an increased risk of illness. I want to say this exactly right, and then ask you to expand on why that is. If I said it right, is that true? And then why is that?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. There was a big study from the Institute of Medicine that came out back in 2002. They really pulled a lot of information together about families in diverse communities. It was called Unequal Treatment, and it codified and lent a lot of research weight to what the families in our communities already know, that most diseases are 2 to 3 times more frequent and more severe. So that means that neonatal mortality and infant mortality is 2.5 to 3 times higher in general. Rates of prematurity for babies is higher, which leads to more difficult outcomes, that life-limiting chronic diseases are 70, 80, 90% higher, that the lifespan is different in low-income and diverse communities, such that in South Seattle, which is a big area that our clinic serves, there are neighborhoods there where the life expectancy is 10 years less than in other parts of King County. People can look just across small spans of water or drive just a quarter mile or two and see a decade or so difference in life expectancy because of these differences in health outcomes related to socioeconomics and race.
The gentleman we talked about just before we came on the air, Dr. Stephen Bezruschka at the School of Public Health, is who really got me understanding and reading about this issue of socioeconomic level and disease and lifespan outcomes. And I remember one of the really classic studies on this was the Whitehall study in England, where they have a bunch of people who have equal access to health care. It has nothing to do with what your socioeconomic group is, but work within the government. And based on your socioeconomic standing, the risk of disease and outcomes were very much kind of stair-stepped up that socioeconomic scale, even though access to health care, at least it appeared, was the same. And that was even after controlling for things like smoking and alcohol use.
Yeah, it's amazing in this country. There's a wonderful series that I'm sure you've seen or heard of called Unnatural Causes that really unpacks a lot of these issues. It's a video series of, I believe, 7 different stories, each about 30 minutes long, that takes some of these issues and pulls them apart a little bit. One is about how important place is, how place matters, how your neighborhood determines your health, perhaps to a greater extent than any other individual characteristic, even your own income that you have within that neighborhood. There's another one that talks about the issues of infant mortality and how concerns about racism in the healthcare system and in society lend to higher rates of infant mortality, even despite socioeconomics. There's another section on the experience of American Indians, especially in the Southwest, and how how the deprivation of lands and traditions and foods and culture really has led to such a protracted and significantly different kind of set of health outcomes for different communities. It's very powerful stuff. And if anybody in the audience has a group that they're thinking about sharing some information regarding this, I would really commend this Unnatural Causes to them.
Yeah, we'll look that up and see if we can get a link. I've already written it down, and so people can also go to our website to link if we can find that link. So why would it be that health outcomes have very little relationship to access to health care? And also, I would have to quickly add to the amount, the level of spending for health care. And I can easily use the example of the United States, where we've mentioned on the program that there's ample evidence we spend more than, by far, than any other healthcare than any other country, and yet our consistently measured similar parameters of health outcomes have actually decreased over the last 25 or 30 years.
Yeah, so true. It's really sad across the board. There are a couple of ways to think about that, and one is just the very, very obvious and very true statement that health care doesn't have as much to do with your health as many other things do. And so it's just important to remember that, so that no matter how much you spend on health care, you might not impact health as much as you think you would. I think a second thing to think about is the way the healthcare system here is designed, and the perverse incentives we have with third-party payer systems and a lot of systems that promote care that drives finances rather than care that improves well-being. And that's a really sad statement. I think on top of that, healthcare in the U.S. sits within a U.S. system that makes it hard to be healthy. One of our biggest challenges that Dr. Brzuchka has talked about and many others is the wealth gap. The difference between the haves and the have-nots is greater in the U.S. than in just about any other country. And correlating to that, you can see health outcomes that are worse. And there is a group of epidemiologists in London who wrote a great book, treatise, called The Spirit Level, in which they lay out a lot of the evidence and look at a lot of the case for how differences between the haves and have-nots, the greater the wealth gap, then the worse the outcome for health, whether it be a well-being measure like high school dropout rates or teen pregnancy, or a true health measure like the UNICEF overall measure of child well-being. In each one of those measures, as you get into greater health disparity, you also see greater wealth disparity. It's pretty impressive. So those are just a few of the reasons. I think on a more local level, there was a grandmother when I first started working in the clinic at Odessa Brown Clinic that really taught me this lesson before I could fully learn it in a more replete way. She brought her and her two grandsons that she was taking care of, and she said, you know, both of my sons have high blood pressure, and they're only 10 and 11 years old, my grandsons. And she said something like, it's really not a surprise to me considering what their lives are like. But it was a shock to me because as a pediatrician just coming out of training, I just did not think I was going to be treating high blood pressure anymore. I thought that was something that I could leave behind with my Alzheimer training and other aspects of care that didn't seem like they belonged in pediatrics. And yet here in this community were young children and tweens with essential hypertension already. And what she was starting to teach me about is something that we tend to understand better and better these days around the adverse childhood experiences and the constant stress levels that some communities face and the sort of unending drip, drip, drip of cortisol that really tends to affect every organ in the body and leads to earlier and more severe illnesses and, unfortunately, earlier death.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm trying to put a face on this idea analogy that you made about the drip, drip, drip of cortisol, so that listeners can understand, is if you grow up in a situation where there may be more constant noise, you may not have enough heat in the winter, you may at times have less access to food than you would like, you may hear gunshots out the window. All of that revs up our natural stress response and can have long-term consequences. Is that what you're talking about?
That's very well put. Absolutely. There's an important distinction between sort of good stress and stress responses and not so good stress and stress responses, that it's really important to have a good stress response when things are really intensely happening and you need to alter your body function in order to respond. However, when your external stressors never go below the threshold of triggering your hormonal responses, or even when they are just very, very slow levels of stress, but they are constant, then it really starts to change your body function. It changes the hormones and other chemicals that bathe your brain. It changes the way your white blood cells respond to stimuli and triggers. It changes the way your overall behavioral responses occur and how well you respond to stressors and how well you can weather criticisms and denigrations and things like that. And that kind of stuff leads to higher rates of heart disease and tumor growth and infections and the way you respond to infections, and greater fragility as you get older. Jack Shonkoff, who's a researcher at Harvard, has really been the leader in this idea of understanding adverse childhood experiences and how they link up to lifelong health. He's even been able to do some research that shows that the number of adverse childhood experiences, we call them ACEs, the number of ACEs you have in your life combine to sequentially increase the chances that you will have lifelong health problems like cardiovascular disease or mental health problems, things like that. And then further, he's also started to help us really understand this concept of epigenetics, that not only does the stress that we experience affect our own bodies, but that experience can affect us for one or two or more generations after our own lives.
Mm-hmm. So back to the observation, or the unfortunate observation, that you were going to have to address high blood pressure in this group of this families that you were seeing, and the evidence is being drawn that when we can't find at least physical causes and we're left with what we call essential hypertension, that it may be these lifelong experiences affecting our body over time that raises our risk for the high blood pressure, which then raises the risk for heart disease and may move us in funny ways in how we eat and increase our diabetes risk and weight and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think it calls on us in the healthcare field and in communities in general to think that we have to start thinking so differently about our traditional healthcare system. And I know a lot of communities are already so far ahead of what Western medicine has to offer in terms of ways to think about this. But as you said in the opening, all of our communities are becoming more and more diverse. And we know that for diverse and historically minority cultures in this country, all of those health issues, both within the healthcare system and in those communities themselves, lead to greater risks for poor health outcomes. So we have to think differently, and we don't have a chance to sort of lay back and wait on this. Our communities, our country is diversifying in such a rapid way and in such a beautiful way, such a wonderful way, that it's beyond time for our healthcare system to incorporate some new strategies and some new ways to provide a better service across the board. And one of those, just to move a little bit along, is thinking about stuff that goes well beyond the reach of our stethoscopes, that we really need to incorporate our ideas of healthcare and promoting well-being into the kinds of services that are actually the basic concerns and things that influence someone's health, if you understand the way stresses contribute. In our clinic, we have really had to learn that the times that we're able to provide food vouchers or contribute to a community garden or go with a family to their grocery store and see if we can work with them to figure out how to shop more effectively for healthier foods within their neighborhoods, or perhaps work with community builders on decreasing the number of food deserts we have. Those are the actual activities that in my heart, really seem to be the things that are going to impact health to a greater degree than my ability to keep up with the most modern medications for type 2 diabetes, as an example.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Benjamin Danielson. He's a pediatrician a clinical professor at the University of Washington Department of Pediatrics. And primarily, we're discussing his job and role as medical director of the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle. We've getting some background information about where we are in this country in understanding health, and particularly some chronic health diseases that are becoming increasingly an issue in our health, and moving towards pretty quickly the idea of where culture fits into this issue and how it more greatly complicates perhaps how we are going to be able to meet those demands. If you've got questions or comments over the next 40 or 50 minutes, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Danielson, let's go ahead and talk some about culture, and we need to start with a definition. What do we mean by culture?
I think culture is one of those very, very malleable and bendable terms, and it's not always easy to get great agreement on what we mean by culture. I like to think about culture as a shared set of values, a shared knowledge, a shared belief system, a shared set of morals and customs and rules and habits that help to describe a group of people. It's not a label, and it's not supposed to be a blueprint. It's not supposed to determine exactly how every person behaves, but in a way, cultures tend to inform some of the ideas and actions that that do help members of a certain culture decide and take action. There are different layers of culture as well, from everyone's personal culture, which may incorporate components of race and ethnicity, but also socioeconomics and your experiences and your geography and your political views and your context, where you live and how you think about things. So that's kind of the broader framework from which I tend to talk about culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a tendency, or at least I did coming onto the program, that culture also has something to do with where you're from and what part of the world. For example, there may be a South African culture and an American culture, but as you talked about this, I realized, well, there's a healthcare culture or a medical culture, and we may share that medical culture in the U.S. with South Africa, so or maybe parts of Europe, and so it's not limited by political borders and so forth. I would hazard to guess here.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think there's another thing you're implying there, that we move in and out of either stronger or lesser alignment with whatever we might sort of describe as our culture. There may be situations mm-hmm. where we adopt a more closely concordant kind of cultural identity, and other times when we are a little bit more moving into some other component of that. Mm-hmm. And I think in healthcare, we have to understand that as a dominant system, a powerful dominant system, when we work with different cultures, that those different cultures are influenced by many things, like just for instance, where there has been an invasion, say, of a Caucasian culture into a non-Caucasian culture, where there's been settlement or resettlement, where geographies have shifted or territories have shifted, that history has a huge influence on culture. And this, if I could take a second, has an important thing with an implication for medical care, because I work with cultures that have a shared memory of real wrongdoing and maltreatment by research and by the healthcare system. And that memory stays alive. Mm-hmm. And there are instances and ongoing issues with institutional racism that exist today. That combination of a real history that's remembered and a current contemporary experience that is known really influences the way people think about the healthcare system and how difficult it might be for people in the healthcare system to really establish and maintain trust.
Good points. Dr. Danielson, we have a phone call, and I want to take that call before we take our mid-program break. Chris, you're on line one.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
What a wonderful conversation, first of all, and thank you for having it. And, Doctor, you've just diagrammed beautifully, you know, the social economic factors of poverty and how that affects health, and I learned some of that in my social work studies. My question, and I hope I can just narrow it down, when we talk about lower social economic people, you know, there's that culture, and then there's the culture of the United States where we, you know, race is just an important and a big factor. And most people in the lower social economic strata are usually people of color, Native Americans, African Americans, things like that. Why do you think it takes such prompting, you know, of majority culture people to acknowledge, accept, and understand the, you know, the things that affect lower social economic strata, and especially people of color? Why does it take prompting to embrace this type of diversity, and especially in light of us knowing, you know, a lot of the things, the learned helplessness, I think you kind of outlined it there, that really affects our health and our well-being. Why do you think you know, we need such goading to...
Why don't we understand it better? Right.
Yeah. Wonderful question. And Dr. Woodward warned me that his audience has great, great, tough questions. So thank you for starting off with a real challenging one. I think
I'm going to listen to the answer and get off the phone.
All right. Thanks for your call, Chris.
Thank you.
I think it's an important question and a difficult one to answer in some ways. There's one thing that is important to remember, and that is that there is something about power here and a power structure and a tradition that is something that has to be contended with on one level or another. And what I mean by that is, especially in the healthcare system, there's almost a lack of awareness about how powerful the dominant culture really is. And related to that, throughout society, the idea of addressing some of these issues actually also involves maybe giving something up if you're in power, giving something up, even if it's a small thing or a more of a theoretic thing than a tangible thing. When you are asked to give up power, that is a struggle. And whether you're the best person in the world, the Dalai Lama, the a wonderful soul, when it comes down to actually sharing or giving up power, that's a huge struggle. Another thing I would say, and I think it's pretty true in Seattle, which is, tends to be politically correct and probably very true in Alaska as well, is that so many people in areas like ours feel like they are good people of good conscience who do good things. And in some ways, what I've found is that it actually makes it harder to address some of the uncomfortable truths of our history and of our current challenges. It's hard to ask somebody to acknowledge it, that they are playing a part in a system, just as I do, that is unbalanced and unfair. I think it's also, finally, my last point is just that I think sometimes we become victims of the soundbite, and it can sometimes sound very, very appealing to hear somebody at a distance say something like, well, if people would only pull themselves up by their bootstraps, everything would be okay. Or if we didn't just make it so easy for somebody not to get a job, then they would be out there getting a job. These very, very simple and very, very inaccurate kinds of statements are sometimes easier ways to rest heavy heads on difficult topics than it is to wrestle with the more complex and more challenging issues that exist in this world, that we would love to have equal opportunity for all, and therefore be able to present everything equally to everyone and see everyone just have their own chance to flourish. But we do not live in a society of equality right now. And so what we have to work on today is equity, which is actually addressing imbalances, sometimes reshifting resources, sometimes investing in people and communities for whom the benefits of investing in them will be something that will help all of us in the future. Thinking about those things are difficult topics. Sometimes we all get subsumed by our own day-to-days, and to really step up and out of the challenges that we face individually and really try to understand through someone else's eyes and in someone else's shoes how their lives are led is asking a lot.
Very well done. Chris actually called back and said, you did it. He helped him understand as a good answer to his question. Let's take our break right now. I want to remind listeners one more time, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. We do have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and the email address line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll rejoin my guest, Dr. Benjamin Danielson, and continue our discussion of the effect of culture on healthcare, which is where we're going in a big way right now. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Benjamin Danielson. He is a clinical professor at the University of Washington Department of Pediatrics and medical director of the Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle. If you have questions or comments, you can email us during the rest of the program. We only have about 25 minutes or so, though, at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Please remember you can listen to the program between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, which is a taped rebroadcast, and you can go to alaskapublic.org and click on Line 1 link and then our archives and listen to the program at any time that you would like. Dr. Danielson, if we're going to talk about the effects of culture on healthcare, let's talk about me. Let's talk about the U.S. medical culture. What is our culture? How do we need to understand our culture before we talk about all these other cultures that are interacting with us?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I think that's such an important point to really recognize that Western healthcare is a culture. Well, Western healthcare could be a country, right? We have our own sort of form of dress with white coats of various lengths. We have our own sort of set of hierarchies with the fanciness of the blue embroidery on your jacket sometimes implying where your rank is within a the healthcare system. We have words that we like to use a lot and end in itis or osis. We have values that we hold very high, like the p-value in a research study, and we hold those higher than personal stories or anecdotes or personal experiences or shared wisdom. So the healthcare system is its own culture, and on top of that, it incorporates the culture of our dominant American society at the same time. So it's a pretty fascinating thing to think about the United States of healthcare on some level, and notice that in every possible way you could call it its own individual culture.
And so the patient then brings with them, or the patient's family or immediate milieu brings with them, their own culture. And that's where things can go awry if we are not culturally aware, I suspect, is what you're going to tell us.
Absolutely. And I think everybody knows this, but it's worth stating, you know, when we come into the healthcare system, our understanding of illness is really influenced by our culture and sometimes by melded ideas in our culture. I talk sometimes about how sometimes we have individual explanations for illness. You know, I didn't exercise enough, therefore I'm overweight and now I have diabetes. There are some forms of natural explanation for illness that incorporate just the world around us. There are supernatural reasons for illness, you know, that just end up being the sort of acts of God or the effects of some force on us that is not of this world. There are social causes for diseases related to the people around us and things like that. So all of those can happen and be values that influence any individual person's healthcare ideas and understanding. And what's important to know is that the healthcare system doesn't necessarily see all of those different illness causes or illness influencers in the same way. And we in the healthcare system can just be very blinded by our own training, which we worked very hard to achieve, and by our own understanding of illness, and not as willing or as ready to hear someone describe their understanding of disease in their own words and in their own frame of reference. And that's where the idea of trying to understand cultures and to approach cultures in a more effective way when the culture is different from you becomes important. When people are very much like you, there's so many different ways you can understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. You can understand what their body language is. You can understand the nonverbal and verbal cues that are giving you information about that person, and you tend to be very accurate and very comfortable in the way that you interact with them. When someone's not like you, much more likely to misinterpret cues, to struggle to understand the way someone is explaining something, and your brain, all of our brains, tend to head towards shortcuts. We tend to head towards quick assumptions or generalizable tidbits of information about someone from a different culture. We tend to lump a bunch of people together in our assumptions of how they think and how they act. And that's where stereotype and bias starts to work its way in. In my training, I learned at first about this idea of cultural competency. And in that, the main components were really to focus on the most vulnerable populations, and it actually encouraged a bit of stereotyping. And finally, I think the traditional way of teaching cultural competency in many organizations and schools also sort of implies this level of mastery that once you've passed the test, you are therefore culturally competent at some absolute level. And I found that just not fitting with the way I think that we should be considering interacting with cultures. It felt very one size felt all fits all, and it felt very inappropriate stereotyping. Mm-hmm. So that's where I've become much more interested in this idea of cultural humility.
I want to come back to the cultural humility, but we do have a couple of calls. I want to see what the questions and issues they're raising. Sharon, you're on line one.
Oh, thank you very much. My question is really kind of focused on my experience here in Alaska, and I live in the largest town, Anchorage, but at the same time, my husband and I have been doing a lot of travel to communities across the state. Because of recognition that we've developed, spending time in Juneau and in state government and seeing that that there is a divide between rural and urban, and that divide is one that's just not understood because of the very things that have been talked about, and that we aren't really understanding that the first Alaskans, the first Americans, were here for many thousands of years before we got here, and very, very high technology for the times that they were in, comparing them to the rest of the world. But now we have a tendency to send them food when we, for instance, change the patterns of when they can hunt, that kind of thing, and the food is not food that they normally eat. That kind of thing has one culture affecting another culture, and really difficulty on a personal and political level understanding how those misunderstandings are affecting the people that are the first people and living in places we can't easily live still. We can't make it. And we can only do it with them being there. So my question is, how can you see developing a bigger conversation so that we as people can get out there and talk more? Do you have ways that you've developed ways to really bring people together better and begin to try to broaden the appreciation of differences that are incredibly wonderful and possibly terribly important for us in the future?
All right. Thanks, Sharon. I'm going to let you take that answer offline and ask Dr. Danielson. Not only so, that's a more generic question than the healthcare issue, but I think we can make that connection. So, Dr. Danielson?
Again, another really wonderful question, and I'm so impressed that people are really contending with and struggling with and really trying to wrestle with these kinds of concerns. It says a lot about everybody who's asking questions like this. I was leading into this idea of cultural humility, and what I would say about that, your question, Sharon, is that perhaps an approach like the cultural humility mindset at least offers a way to think about solving some of the problems of bridging these divides that feel like they are unbridgeable historically, because it really asks a couple of things of you. First and foremost, to spend a little more time understanding your own culture and your own belief systems and unpacking the way you think about worldview and really identifying who you are within your culture. And then it asks a couple of basic things. It asks you to be willing to be on a bit of a continuous journey. Sometimes when we see great challenges or the chasm is so wide, we think we need to just fix it all at once, and we can't fix it all at once, therefore it is an insurmountable problem. And I think with a mindset like cultural humility and others, it's a continuous growth process. You are slowly building those bridges, and you are continuously working on trying to span the differences in beliefs with a sense of appreciation. Another component of thinking about cultural humility is how it requires a sense of openness and coming to situations not as an expert. This is especially true in the healthcare system as doctors, but I think it's true for anybody walking into a community that they're not familiar with, laying aside those assumptions that have built up about the groups that you are interacting with, and really coming in with I don't know, I am not an expert about issues, about what you need, about what your strengths or weaknesses are. I'm coming to you to learn from you. It asks also at the same time, and this sounds like a contradiction, but I don't think it is, that you acknowledge when there are power differences. You acknowledge that as part of a dominant culture, the power dynamics are not equally distributed, at the same time that you're open to learning more about someone else. It asks you to take a journey of building trust. In healthcare, that becomes especially important when you're trying to negotiate a care plan and things like that. But in relationships within and across communities, that trust building is especially important. And then finally, it really asks you to develop your listening skills. And that's something that all of us could use some extra time trying to learn. I think if you took a cultural humility kind of perspective into the way that you encourage yourself and others to interact more with people from different backgrounds who are not like you, it doesn't give you the recipe for the answers, but it sure gives you, I don't know, maybe the right mixing bowl and the right measuring cups to divine those recipes, if that makes any sense.
All right. Thanks very much. I'm going to move on and take another caller real quick, Dr. Danielson. Kay, you're on line one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was waiting on hold, and you brought up the topic I wanted to, which is cultural humility. I became aware of this, this idea 4 or 5 years ago at a palliative care conference here, and just this last year I've been able to delve into it a little bit more and do a presentation at a palliative care conference out of state. And my background is anthropology, and so I never, too, felt like, you know, I'm not going to be culturally competent ever because I'm not a member of that culture, but I can be sensitive to it. So for me, it's really spoken to the way that I've lived my life and practiced my work. And I would really be interested in seeing, you know, how we might be able to, you know, offer more information about it and kind of move more quickly for our providers to be able to do that. And also that recognition as a, I'm a Caucasian, so as a member of the dominant culture, the recognition of the privilege that I had, that I grew up with, that I lived my life, you know, just because I'm a white woman, you know, I have certain privileges that other people don't. And recognizing that, I think, is a really important component of that cultural humility.
That's a wonderful point. Thank you for contributing that. I think you've nailed it on the head. And I'll bet you would know this person, but there's a doctor named Melanie Turvalon who works in San Francisco who has really helped to build this conversation around cultural humility, Turvalon, T-E-R-V-A-L-O-N, and she might be another wonderful guest for your show at some point.
All right, thanks. Kate, thanks for your comments.
Thank you.
How are you addressing specifically culturally more appropriate care, cultural awareness in the Odessa Brown Clinic?
Oh, that's a really good question, and this is definitely something that we're on as much of a journey as anywhere else. And in fact, sometimes clinics like ours think that they are somehow provided a pass, like we don't need to address these issues because we have diversity in our staff and things like that, and it makes the challenge even more interesting. We do a few things, and in my role at the university, too, I have the privilege of getting to work with up-and-coming medical students and doctors and get to sort of talk with them about this idea, and especially in building listening skills and respectful inquiry. Sometimes a lot of the medical students I work with are very kind of linear, and they just want to know what they can use as a tool. And for them, we might offer little mnemonics. Like there's one I use called HUMBLE, H-U-M-B-L-E, which just gives them a few key words to sort of trigger ways to ask about how people understand illness. humble, being humble about assumptions. The U is for understanding how your own background and culture impacts your care of patients. M is about motivating both yourself to learn about the patient's background, but also being motivated to really understand beliefs and practices. The B is for beginning to incorporate your knowledge as you move along in your practice. L is for lifelong learning. I tell students, you're always a student and you're always a teacher as well. And then E is for emphasizing respect and really using respectful discourse when you negotiate treatment plans and when you engage with families from different cultures. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm.
We do some assessments. We try to look at a lot of the work we do through an equity lens. So we have a little litmus test for equity that we try to put into our work that tries to pull us out of our own shoes a little bit, also tries to make us think about unintended consequences from the perspective of people who might not think exactly along the same lines as us. And most importantly, lately, I've been finally taking more time to pull together all of the knowledge that people like that grandmother I first mentioned have been trying to teach me over the years, and I've really been trying to develop a resilience repository, the kinds of skills and information and strategies that really resilient families in the face of many challenges utilize successfully. And we both try to learn from that essentially, but we also try to tailor some of our clinic programs to meet those resilient strategies more effectively. And the quick thing I would say about that is sometimes in healthcare systems, you only have one way that you can access services. And if you don't show up on time for your appointment, then you failed your appointment and it's a failure. Resilient parents have told me that you always need a plan A, B, C, D, E, and F. So when we develop scheduling systems and follow-up appointments and things like that, we develop them with an A, B, C, and D at least that allow multiple ways for a family to be successful at engaging with us.
Hmm. That's a very good point. That last one for clinics, scheduling is one of our every clinic's most demanding task, and that's a very good way of thinking about that. Thank you. One more call. Carolyn, you're on line one.
Thank you, sir. One of the things I wanted to get to has to do with the money, but first I wanted to thank you and all the callers. You mentioned the word that I have always put out there in front, and that is respect. And with the humility and the openness demonstrates respect, and that gets you a long way in terms of dealing with other people. In the mid-80s, I worked for a firm that helped fund a parenting clinic here. It was an emergency clinic for a crisis that might happen with parents and children and not being able to handle something appropriately. And that funding went away. There were classes, parenting classes offered. It was just a wonderful resource for this community. Funding went away, not necessarily, I mean, it collapsed, so whatever funding we were giving was not able to sustain it. And I'm wondering how you can approach people that could give the funds and those that want to withhold funding because of the generational aspect of this. I think we are seeing now the neglect that we've done for 75 years or more. And as I say, the chickens are coming home to roost. And how do we get these people to understand that it is to their financial interest to intercede and help families, because families are not connected with grandparents and so forth as we were 75 years ago and more. And so, again, how do we reach these people and say, this will save you money in the long run?
All right.
And not just the companies, but the individuals and the power and the leadership.
All right. Carolyn, great question. Thank you. We've got about 3 minutes, Dr. Daniels.
Well, an engaged civic population is the most effective tool that people with a strong, passionate voice like yours can using it in the government circles and in the funding circles is really important. I think funders are learning a little bit, but still struggle with the idea of where to place their return on investment measurements. And sometimes we slant too much of our funding towards looking for short-term outcomes when a lot of what you're talking about are things that really are going to take time to bring benefit back, just like they've been taking their time bringing the hardship back to communities that haven't been able to use those resources. I think these funding cycles are a real challenge for us to face, and it's always these kinds of programs, as you mentioned, the parenting clinics and things like that, that are the first on the chopping blocks when the budgets get tight. That's why we have to be civically engaged citizens. We have to speak up. We have to let our legislators know what we prioritize and what's important to us. And we have to be able to speak to the non-governmental funders as well and say, these are the kinds of investments that we think are really important to make in our communities. And let me tell you, those big investors, even the Bill Gates and those guys, they really like to hear from communities themselves about what is important. So I just encourage everybody to use their voices, their powerful tools as voices, to convey what's really important.
And I guess I'm always a lumper, not a splitter, but realizing that the policymakers have their cultural aspects, we have our cultural aspects, and that the humble model might be the meeting point.
Yes, maybe we should do a legislative retreat where we do a cultural humility session for the legislators.
All right.
I'd be in for that.
All right. We're in our last minute, and I think this is a time I like to just leave it to my guest to reframe this. What's important? What do we want to remember to take away from the program today?
I think it's important just to remember that we all come from significant informing cultures that really say a lot about who we are, and it's always worth taking a moment to sort of know ourselves a little bit better. Knowing ourselves makes us so much better at being open to knowing other people. I want to reemphasize the idea of respect that our last caller brought up, that respect is one of the most important gifts that you can give to someone else. And it helps lead to one of the most important commodities I've learned about in the way we provide care in our clinic at the Odessa Brown Clinic, and that is trust. If you don't have trust, you don't have anything. The opportunity to work with more people who are not like you is such an amazing, mind-growing, experience-blowing kind of thing that we should be striving very hard to build our skills to be ready for 2020, for the next future that we see in our coming up to us. And I'll close by just saying there was an American Indian leader at a large meeting once who said, if every time you go to a meeting, everyone talks like you, everyone looks like you, and everyone agrees with you, then you're probably going to the wrong meetings.
Very good advice. Thanks very much for your time and expertise today, Dr. Danielson.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Danielson with the University of Washington Department of Pediatrics and the Medical Director of Odessa Brown Children's Clinic in Seattle. Our very much best thanks. Our next program will feature Prentice Pemberton as the host, and he'll be continuing in part three of Parenting the Modern Teen, where they're tackling sex, drugs, extreme oppositional behavior, and even other high-risk behavior. So tune in next week at this time for that program. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and helped today on engineering. Thanks for listening, and really, have a great day out there. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.